Hi, everybody. I'm Arun Venugopal, and this is The Takeaway. In India, protests continue against a law passed over a month ago that grants citizenship based on religion. Critics say the law openly discriminates against Muslims. Women, in particular Muslim women, have been on the front lines of the protests and show no signs of slowing down. But the continued conflict has come at a cost. Amid alleged police brutality, thousands have been arrested and around 30 people have been killed. Here to explain the latest on these protests is journalist Barkha Dutt, author, journalist, and Washington Post columnist. She's been covering the situation from Delhi, India. Hi, Barkha.
Hi, Arun. Pleasure to be on.
Remind us exactly why this law, the Citizenship Amendment Act, has generated so much anger in the country.
To understand why the citizenship legislation is so contentious and so divisive, one has to understand that it allows fast-track citizenship to non-Muslims from three Muslim countries, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Bangladesh. And for the first time ever in India's history, you have a kind of religious exceptionalism, a religious filter being applied to the notion of citizenship, and therefore many believe to the very idea of the Indian nation. What weaponizes this new citizenship legislation is a proposed second law, which hasn't been executed yet, called the NRC, which stands for the National Register of Citizens. This is what the BJP government wants to impose nationally, and this will require everybody to prove that they have the documents to show that they are legal citizens of India. And what a lot of us believe, and a lot of the protesters believe, is that this could lead, one, to the poor having to prove their citizenship many times over, because often they're the ones without documentation. And two, we might see Muslim migrants being the only ones in internment camps, and we might see India's Muslims being even more pushed to the margins than they have been politically in the last few years.
And we're also hearing reports of one or more detention centers being built, correct?
They have been built in one particular state of Assam, which is an eastern state in India, which is where this NRC that I mentioned, the National Register of Citizens, was ordered to be executed by the Supreme Court. And that has been the government's defense that the citizenship project in the eastern state of Assam was in fact mandated by the judiciary. But once it took place in Assam and didn't quite go according to the ruling government's plans, because suddenly they found that there were at least 50% Hindus among those who found themselves off the rolls and without papers. And so even the Modi government wants a recount there. But once they imposed this citizenship project in Assam under the orders of the court, they started talking about doing this nationally. And they first brought in the citizenship legislation as step one towards achieving this. So I just want to clarify, detention centers have been built in the state of Assam. You have a minister in the government that actually told India's parliament that 28 people have died in this detention center in Assam since these detention centers were built. And nationally, we have, as journalists, seen an internal government order that speaks of building these kind of detention centers in other cities of India. This has not happened thus far, but we have seen a kind of proposed order that speaks of it.
These protests are happening across the country, and they've been taking place every day for over a month. What do you think has sustained them for so long?
What's very, very interesting is that I see these protests as an attempt to reclaim nationalism. We live in an age where there is one particular phrase that is used for anybody who goes against the dominant political narrative in India, and the phrase is anti-national. If you disagree at all with the dominant narrative, you're called a traitor, you're called treacherous, you're called anti-national. And in Hindi, there's a phrase that is used for a lot of dissenters called the tukre-tukre gang, which means people who want to see the country being broken to bits. Now, you would imagine that this is a very volatile and kind of dangerous phrase to use against someone who doesn't agree with you, but that's what's been happening. And what we see at these protests is a kind of reclaiming of the nation. And you will see this in the symbols that are being used. You will see the Indian tricolor everywhere. You will see the preamble to the Indian constitution being read out at all protests. You will see the architects of India's freedom movement, in particular Mahatma Gandhi and B.R. Ambedkar, the Dalit scholar who was the architect of India's constitution. You will see those posters. The students are marching against the new citizenship projects. They're marching to reclaim the constitution. And they're also marching against brutalities that took place against students in the form of police excesses and excess force on several of the campuses where these protests erupted. So in many ways, this is not an opposition-led movement. It's a people-led movement. And it's a movement that's being led by India's young and also by India's women, in particular, India's Muslim women.
A few days ago, you were at Shaheen Bagh in New Delhi, where you interviewed Muslim women in particular, some of whom were dressed in the colors of the Indian flag. What were they telling you about their presence there and why they're so motivated?
You know, Shaheen Bagh has become India's version of Occupy Wall Street. The context is very different, but it is the same sort of spirit where you have this people-led, women-led vigil, and it's now been more than a month. Shaheen Bagh is a nondescript neighborhood in India's capital, Delhi. Where the women sit night after night, often in plummeting temperatures, is a bus stop. And you kind of go through these narrow alleys and back lanes of a bustling bazaar. It opens up to this sort of compound space where there are, you know, just under very simple tents, you have all of these women sitting and you have a small stage where people are welcome to come and make speeches, men and women both. And of course, this is essentially, I would say, a lower income neighborhood. The women, many of them are educated, many of them are old, some of them are young. I have met a woman protester as old as 90 years old. I've also met, 18-year-olds. Typical evening at Shaheen Bagh would be sometimes tens of thousands of women, their little children, the Indian flag painted on the faces of these children. Some babies are asleep under the blankets. Everybody kind of huddles together. And there's a lot of speeches and poetry. And what's really intriguing is that although these started off as protests, the atmosphere is very celebratory. It's almost like a wedding. There's cups of tea and there's biryani being cooked at the back. And I like to say, because it's a women-led vigil, everybody's asked, have you eaten? Don't go without eating. So, you know, it's very different from how men would run protests.
Yeah. I think for some of them, they told you that this is a way not just to assert their democratic rights, but also it's pushing back against the stereotype of Muslim women as being downtrodden, correct?
Yes. So the very interesting thing is that, you know, if you were to deconstruct this in terms of a feminist debate, there could be a million views because many of the women are in complete parda. You know, some are behind the burqa, some are not in either a burqa or a hijab. So it's quite multicultural. And one of the posters there actually had a woman wearing a hijab and also wearing a bindi, which is the traditional ornamental forehead vermilion sort of paste that Hindu women use. And the poster kind of had both and just said, does it matter? And I think what women were trying to say is that, look, you can park all your other debates for later. We're here collectively to fight a much bigger battle, and that is for our country, our place in the Indian Union. And, you know, repeatedly, women have, in fact, said this to me, that the Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, when he was legislating against the triple talaq custom, which is a custom which allows instant divorce by simply saying the words, talak, talak, talak. At that, you know, he made the argument that Muslim women must find their voice. Muslim women must be given the space to express themselves. And these women, more than one, told me that, look, the Prime Minister said we must find our voice, and here we are. This is our voice.
So how is the Prime Minister responding to these protests?
Prime Minister so far has not directly engaged with any of the protesters. It's not as if he's called some of the students over or called some of these women for talks. Instead, you have seen the government doubling down on the new citizenship legislation. Prime Minister and his very powerful lieutenant, the Home Minister Amit Shah, have accused journalists like myself of offering a kind of selective narrative. And I think that the government calculates, despite these protests, that there might be some electoral advantage for it in parts of the country. They seek to present these protests as Muslim protests, and thereby they believe, I imagine, that there would be a consolidation of the Hindu vote as a counter to these Muslim protests. Hence, you will see that at Shaheen Bagh itself, there has been a great effort to underline the secular nature of this agitation. There have been interfaith songs. There have been people of all religions. There have been people of all communities who have come and shared the stage, because I think there's an attempt to say that, yes, although this is a vigil led by women and Muslim women, it doesn't speak only for Muslims. This isn't just Muslims speaking for Muslims. This is Indians speaking for the possible disenfranchisement or marginalization, if you will, of India's Muslims.
From the Indian point of view, is it significant that this is getting international attention now, especially against the backdrop of an economy that's really not doing as well as many people think it should be doing?
So I think the economy is the headline there, right? I think the Indian Or perhaps the government thinking has been that as long as India remains a sort of critical market, the world's media may sort of carp a bit, but the governments need India's business and they need India's market. But if the economy continues to nosedive and doesn't recover, then I think that leverage that India as an emerging superpower of this region has enjoyed will diminish. And therefore, I think what how the world reacts and how India counters that is going to depend very much on how the economy performs.
Barkha Dutt is an author, journalist, and Washington Post columnist. Barkha, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.